Not in some weird, perverted way. His hand is just so big compared to mine. And so warm. And the way his fingers are curled around my wrist. It's like they were always supposed to do that. Like they're matching pieces in a jigsaw. I don't know. What am I talking about? Eventually, when we're outside and in the crowd of manic dancers, he slows and does a spin in the mud. It's sort of weird when he gazes at me. Again, I blame the drink. But it's different. He looks so nice standing there. His hair kind of swishing in the wrong direction and the firelight reflecting in his glasses. I think he can tell I've had a bit to drink. "Will you dance with me?" he shouts over the screams. I inexplicably start to cough. He rolls his eyes at me and chuckles. I start thinking about proms and weddings, and for a few seconds I actually forget that we're just in some garden where the ground looks like shit and the people are all dressed in near identical outfits. He removes his hand from my wrist and uses it to flatten his hair. And then he stares at me for what feels like a whole year. I wonder what he sees. Without warning, he grabs both of my wrists and literally kneels at my feet. "Please dance with me," he says. "I know that dancing is awkward and outdated, and I know that you don't like doing stuff like that, and if I'm honest, neither do I. And I know that the night isn't going to last very long, and soon everyone will just go home back to their laptops and their empty beds, and we'll probably be alone tomorrow, and we all have to go to school on Monday. But I just think that if you tried it, you know, dancing, you might feel for a few minutes that all of this, all of these people, none of it is really too bad." I look down and meet his eyes. I start to laugh before kneeling down too. And then I do something really weird. Once I'm on my knees, I really can't help it. I kind of fall forward into him and fling my arms around him. "Yes," I say into his ear. So he puts his arms around my waist, lifts us both to our feet, and resumes pulling me through the adolescent expanses. We reach the center of the crowd clustered around the DJ. He puts his hand on my shoulders. Our faces are centimeters apart. It's so loud, he has to scream. "Yes! Tori, they're playing the Smiths! They're playing the beautiful Smiths, Tori!" The Smiths are the band of the internet. More specifically, and unfortunately, a band that many people listen to simply because Morrissey has that vintage, self-deprecating coolness that everyone seems to crave. If the internet were an actual country, "There Is a Light That Never Goes Out" would be its national anthem. I feel myself slightly step backward. Do you have a blog?" For a second he's confused, but then he just smiles and shakes his head. "Jesus, Tori, do I have to have a blog to like the Smiths? Is that the rule now?" And this is the moment, I guess, when I decide that I can't care less about anything else tonight. I can't care less about blogs, or the internet, or films, or what people are wearing. And yes, yes, I am going to have fun. I am going to have a good time. I am going to be with my one and only friend, Michael Holden, and we are going to dance until we can't even breathe, and we have to go home and face our empty beds. So when we start jumping up and down, smiling so ridiculously, looking at each other and at the sky, and not really at anything, Morrissey singing something about shyness, I really don't think things could be so bad after all. Chapter 26. At 12:16 a.m., I go inside because if I don't pee, I think my bladder will erupt. Everyone is waiting for Solitaire's blog post, which, according to recent rumour, will be published at 12:30 a.m. People are sitting, phones in their hands. I find the bathroom, and when I leave it, I see Lucas, alone in a corner, texting. He sees me staring and jumps up, but rather than walking toward me, he quickly exits, like he's trying to avoid me. I follow him into the living room, intending to apologize for forgetting about hanging out with him today, but he doesn't see me. I watch as he wanders up to Evelyn. She is wearing these hooped earrings, chunky heels, leggings with upside-down crosses on them, and a faux fur coat. Her messy hair is piled up on the top of her head. Lucas, similarly, is in tonight's hipster get-up. A loose Joy Division t-shirt with the sleeves rolled, two tight jeans, and desert boots. Lucas says something to her, and she nods back at him. That's it, I've decided. Despite what Lucas said, they are definitely a couple. I go back outside. It has finally started to snow. Properly. The music's over, but everyone's skipping around, screaming, trying to catch flakes in their mouths. I look out at the scene. The flakes float on the water and dissolve, joining with the river as it sails past me toward the sea. I love snow. Snow can make anything beautiful. It's then that I see Becky again. She's with a guy up against a tree, and I know she's definitely still drunk, because they're not even kissing romantically. I'm about to turn away, but then they move around a little, and I see who the guy is. It's Ben Hope. I don't know how long I stand there, but at some point he opens his eyes and sees me. Becky looks too. She giggles, and then she realizes. I got a drink on my way out, but it's spilt on the snow now, and my hand is just cupping the air. They recoil from me, and then Ben hurries past me and into the house. Becky stays by the tree. She raises her eyebrows at me when I reach her and says, "What?" I wish I were dead. My hands clench and unclench. She laughs. "What? For God's sake!" Becky has betrayed me anyway. Because she doesn't care. "Everything I thought about you," I say, "is wrong." "What are you talking about? Am I hallucinating this? Are you drunk?" "You are a nasty bitch," I say. I think I'm shouting, but I can't really tell. I'm only 70% sure I'm saying any of this out loud. "I used to think that you were just forgetful, but now I have solid proof that you just don't care." "What? Don't try acting like you don't know what you've just done. Grow a backbone. Go on, try and defend yourself. I am literally dying to hear your justification. Are you going to tell me that I don't understand?" Becky's eyes begin to fill with tears, as if she's actually upset. "I'm not. That's it, isn't it? I'm your naive little friend whose sad little life makes you feel better about yourself. Well, you're absolutely spot on there. I haven't got a single clue about anything. But you know what I do know? I know when someone is being a nasty bitch. Go ahead and cry your stupid little crocodile tears if you want to. You don't fucking care at all, do you?" Becky's voice is sober now, if a little wobbly, and she begins to shout at me. "Well, you're the one being a nasty bitch. Jesus Christ, just calm down." I pause. This is bad. I need to stop. I can't. "I'm sorry. Do you have any comprehension of the level of betrayal you have just committed? Do you have any concept of friendship? I didn't think it was possible for someone to be that selfish, but clearly I've been wrong all this time." I think I'm crying. You've killed me. You've literally killed me. Calm down. Oh my God, Tori. You have solidly proven that everyone and everything is shit. Well done, Gold Star. Please delete yourself from my life. And that is it. I am gone. I am gone. I guess everyone is like this. Smiles, hugs, years together, holidays, late night confessions, tears, phone calls, 1 million words. They don't mean anything. Becky doesn't care. No one really cares. The snowfall is blurring my vision, or maybe it's the tears. I stumble back to the house, and just as I enter, people start screaming and holding their phones above their heads. I can't stop crying, but I manage to get out my phone and find the solitaire page. And there is the post. 030, 23rd of January. Solitarians, we would like you to collaborate on our latest venture. At our meetup tonight, there is a Higgs Year 12 named Ben Hope, who has deliberately injured a Truam Year 11. Ben Hope is a known homophobe and a bully who hides behind the facade of popularity. We hope that you will join Solitaire in preventing such acts of violence in the future by giving him exactly what he deserves. Act accordingly. Protect the unprotected. Justice is everything. Patience kills. Chapter 27. There is a tornado of people around me, screaming in all directions, and I can't go anywhere. After several minutes of pandemonium, the flow steadily softens into one direction rather than a whirlpool, and I am torn out of the house in the current. Everyone is in the garden. Someone cries out, "Karma, motherfucker!" Is this karma? Two boys hold Ben Hope while several others hurl punches and kicks at him. Blood splatters onto the snow, and the spectacle gets wild cheers every time a hit is made. Only a few meters away, Nick and Charlie are standing in the crowd, Nick's arm around Charlie, both of their expressions unreadable. Charlie steps forward, as if he's about to intervene, but Nick pulls him back. They exchange a look and then turn away from the show. They walk out of the crowd and disappear. I couldn't stick up for Charlie, and now Solitaire's doing my job for me. I've never been able to do my job properly, I suppose. Then again, maybe this isn't about Charlie. I think back to what Michael said to me in Café Riviere. Oh, God. Maybe it's about me. I laugh, tears still falling, so hard that my stomach aches. Silly. Silly thought. Silly me. Selfish. Nothing is ever about me. Another hit. The crowd shrieks with joy, waving their drinks in the air, like they're at a concert. Like they're happy. Nobody is trying to help. Nobody. Nobody. I don't know what to do. If this were a film, I would be there. I would be the hero stopping this false justice. But this isn't a film. I am not the hero. I start to panic. I turn back into the crowd and break out through the other side. My eyes won't focus. Sirens start to blare, distant in the town. Ambulance? Police? Justice is everything. Patience kills. Michael, out of nowhere, grabs me by the shoulders. He's not looking at me. He's looking at the scene, just like the rest of the crowd, watching but doing nothing, not caring. I throw his hands off me, muttering crazily, "This is what we are. Solitaire. We could just... They'll kill him. You think you've met bad people and then you meet people who are worse. They're doing nothing. They're not. We're just as bad. We're just as bad for doing nothing. We don't care. We don't care that they could kill him.
Tori.
Michael takes hold of my shoulders again, but I step backward and his arms drop. I'll take you home.
I don't want you to take me home.
I'm your friend, Tori. This is what we do.
I don't have any friends. You are not my friend. Stop pretending that you fucking care.
Before he can argue, I'm gone. I'm running. I'm out of the house. I'm out of the garden. I'm out of the world. The giants and demons are rising and I am chasing them. I'm pretty sure I'm going to be sick. Am I hallucinating this? I am not the hero. It's funny, because it's true. I begin to laugh, or maybe I'm crying. Maybe I don't care anymore. Maybe I'm going to pass out. Maybe I'll die when I'm 27.
Part 2. Donnie. A storm is coming, Frank says. A storm that will swallow the children, and I will deliver them from the kingdom of pain. I will deliver the children back to their doorsteps. I'll send the monsters back to the underground. I'll send them back to a place where no one else can see them. Except for me, 'cause I am Donnie Darko. Donnie Darko, The Director's Cut, 2004.
Chapter 1. Lucas was a crier. It happened most days in primary school, and I think it was one of the main reasons I was his friend. I didn't mind the crying. It would come on slowly and then explode. He'd sport this odd expression for a few minutes before. Not sad, but as if he were replaying a television program in his head, watching the events unfold. He'd look down, but not at the ground. And then the tears would start falling. Always silent, never heaving. I don't think that there was a particular reason for the crying. I think that was just his personality. When he wasn't crying, we played chess or lightsaber duels or Pokemon battles. When he was crying, we'd read books. This was the time in my life when I read books. I always felt at my best when we were together. It's funny, I've never found that relationship with another person. Well, maybe Becky, in our early days. When Lucas and I left primary school, we left with the assumption that we would continue to see each other. As all those who have left primary school can guess, this never came to fruition. I saw him only once more after that time, before now, of course. A chance meeting on the high street. I was 12. He told me that he'd sent me an Easter egg in the post. It was May. I hadn't gotten any post since my birthday. At home that evening, I wrote him a card. I said that I hoped that we could still be friends, and I gave him my email address, and I drew a picture of myself and him for good measure. I never sent that card. It stayed in the bottom of my top desk drawer for several years, until I cleared out my room. When I found it, I tore it up and threw it away. I think about all these things as I'm wandering the school on Monday. I can't find him. All this time I've just been sitting around, moaning about how shit everything is, not bothering to try and make things better. I hate myself for that. I'm like all those people in the crowd at the solitaire meetup, not bothering to help. I don't think I can be like that anymore. Michael isn't anywhere to be seen either. He's probably decided to leave me alone for good now, which is fair enough.
I screwed it all up again. Classic Tory. Anyway, I want to talk to Lucas about Saturday. Apologize for not meeting up with him like I said I would. Tell him he doesn't have to avoid me anymore. Twice I think I see his lanky limbs swish around corridor corners, but as I run to catch him, I realize it's just another of the thin-faced sixth-form boys. He's not in the common room before school, at break, or at lunch. After a while, I forget who I'm looking for, and just continue on walking forever. I check my phone several times, but there's only one message on my blog. Anonymous, thought for the day. What is the point in studying literature? Becky and Arlott have not talked to me all day. Ben Hope did not go to the hospital. He wasn't anywhere near death. Some people seem to feel sorry for him, whereas others say he deserved what he got for being a homophobe. I am not sure what I think about it anymore. When Charlie and I talked about it, he seemed pretty shaken up. "This is my fault," he said, grimacing. "It's my fault that Ben was angry in the first place, so it's my fault that Solitaire..." "It's not anyone's fault," I told him, "except Solitaire's." On Tuesday, Kent keeps me back after English. Becky seems to be quietly hopeful that I'm in some kind of severe trouble, but Kent says nothing until everyone is gone. He sits on his desk, arms folded, glasses angled at a nonchalant slant. "Tory, I think we need to talk about your Heroes of Pride and Prejudice essay." It was a very angry essay. "Why did you decide to write it in that way?" "I really hate that book." Kent rubs his forehead. "Yes, I got that impression." He retrieves my essay from a cardboard folder and places it between us. "I am sorry, Mr. Kent," he reads, "but I have not read Pride and Prejudice. I disagreed with the very first sentence, and that was enough for me." Kent looks up at me briefly before skipping to my second paragraph. "Alas, Elizabeth Bennet does not love Mr. Darcy while he is imperfect. Only once his better character is revealed does she decide that she will accept Pemberley and the $100 billion a year. Fancy that. It seems that it is impossible for the females in this novel to look past an exterior and try to dig out the greatness within others. Yes, all right, Elizabeth is prejudiced. I get it. I get it, Jane Austen. Well done." "Yeah," I say, "all right." "I'm not done," chuckles Kent. He skips to my conclusion. "This is why Mr. Darcy is, in my eyes, a true hero. He struggles on, despite being so harshly treated and judged. Pride and Prejudice is one man's fight to be seen by others as he sees himself. Therefore, he is not typical. A typical hero is brave, confident, and dashing. Mr. Darcy is shy, haunted by himself, and unable to fight for his own character. But he loves, and I guess that is all that matters in the world of literature." I should be embarrassed about this, but I'm really not. He sighs. "It's interesting that you identify with a character like Mr. Darcy." "Why?" "Well, most students choose Elizabeth as the strongest character." I look at him squarely. "Mr. Darcy has to put up with everyone hating him for reasons that aren't even true, and he doesn't even complain about it. I'd call that pretty strong." Kent chuckles again. "Elizabeth Bennet is thought to be one of the strongest women of 19th century literature. I take it you're not a feminist." "You think I'm not a feminist because I empathize more with a male in a pretentious 19th century romantic comedy?" He smiles broadly and doesn't answer. I shrug. "It's just what I think." He nods thoughtfully. "Well, That's fair. Don't write so colloquially in your exam, though. You're smart, and it'll get you a bad mark. All right. He hands me back the essay. Listen, Tori. He scratches his chin, making a grating sound against his stubble. I've noticed that you've been quite significantly underachieving in all your AS subjects. He pauses and blinks. I mean, you were doing really very well in Year 11, especially in English. I got a B in my sociology mock last term, I say. That's not that bad. You've been getting D's in English, Tori. People who get 2 A stars in English GCSEs do not then get D's at AS level. Can you think of a reason for why this has happened? He stares at me cautiously. I suppose I don't really like school anymore. Why's that? I just hate being here. My voice dies away. I look up at the classroom clock. I need to go. I need to get to music. He nods very slowly. I think that a lot of people hate being here. He turns his head to the side and glances out of the window. But that's life, isn't it? Yeah. If you go on acknowledging that you hate it, you're never going to want to be here. You can't give up on it. You can't be defeatist about it. Yeah. Okay. I run out the door. Chapter 2. I find Lucas by the lockers at the end of school, and this time he really cannot avoid me. He's with Evelyn and that guy with the quiff. They're all pinching their noses because Solitaire stink-bombed the entire school approximately 1 hour ago. Classic, disgusting, and unnecessary. However, most people in school today seem to be generally supportive of this particular prank. The smell in this corridor is mouldy egg. I cover my mouth and nose with my jumper. Lucas, Evelyn, and Quiff Guy are in conversation, serious conversation, but because I've recently turned into a rude and arrogant person, I don't give a crap that I'm going to interrupt. Why are you avoiding me? I call. Lucas nearly drops several large ring binders and stares around Evelyn's head. He moves his hand away from his nose. Victoria, God! Evelyn and the guy turn and study me suspiciously before slinking away. I step toward Lucas. He's got his bag slung over his shoulder. Are you sure Evelyn isn't your girlfriend? I ask, still holding my jumper over part of my face. What? He laughs nervously. Why do you think that? I always see you with her. Are you her secret boyfriend? He blinks several times. No. Are you lying? No. Are you angry because I forgot we were going to meet up on Saturday? No, I promise I'm not. Then why are you avoiding me? I haven't seen you this week. He shoves the ring binders into the locker and withdraws a sizable art sketchbook. I'm not avoiding you. Don't lie. He flinches. I get it. Lucas has tried so hard since term started to be friends with me again, and I've been such an arse about it. Just because I hate making friends, I've been rude to him. I've ignored him, I've avoided him, and I haven't made a single bit of effort for him. That's me, as usual, being an utter dick to everyone for no apparent reason. I get it. I get that I don't exactly engage with people. But since Saturday, I felt that not engaging can be just as bad as the alternative. Now Lucas doesn't seem to even want to know me. Look, I say, dropping my jumper, feeling desperation sink into my soul. We were best friends once, weren't we? I don't want you to avoid me. I'm sorry I forgot about Saturday. I forget stuff like that. But you're one of three people who I've ever been friends with, and I don't want to not talk to you anymore. He runs a hand through his hair. It's halfway down his forehead. I don't know what to say. Just please tell me why you avoided me on Saturday. Something's different. His eyes shift from side to side. I can't be around you. Then quieter. I can't do this. What? He slams the locker shut. It makes a noise that's far too loud. I've got to go. Just... But he's already walked away. I stand by his locker for a minute or so. The moldy egg smell appears to be intensifying, as does my hatred for solitaire. Lucas forgot to lock his locker properly, so I can't resist opening it and having a look inside. There are three ring binders in there, English literature, psychology, and history, along with a bunch of sheets. I pick one up. It's a psychology sheet about coping with stress. There is a picture of a girl holding her head in both hands, a bit like that famous painting, The Scream. One of the suggestions is regular exercise, and another is writing down your problems. I replace the sheet and shut Lucas's locker. Chapter 3. Grandma and Grandad have come round, the first time in months. We're all at the dinner table, and I'm trying not to catch eyes with anyone, but I keep seeing Mum glance concernedly toward Grandad, and then glance concernedly toward Charlie. Dad's sitting between Charlie and Oliver. I'm at the head of the table.
Your mum's told us you've got back onto the rugby team, Charlie, says Grandad.
When he talks, he leans forward like we can't hear him, even though he speaks twice as loud as everyone else. I think that this is very stereotypical of Grandad.
It's a blessing they let you back on. You really messed them around. What with all that time off?
Yeah, it was really nice of them, says Charlie. He's holding his knife and fork in his hands by the side of his plate.
It feels like we haven't seen Charlie for years, says Grandma. Doesn't it, Richard? Next time we see you, you'll probably have a wife and children.
Charlie forces himself to laugh politely.
Would you pass me the Parmesan, Dad? Asks Mum.
Grandad passes the Parmesan.
A rugby team always needs a skinny one like yourself. To do the running, you understand. If you'd have eaten more earlier on, you would have grown big enough to be one of the proper players. But I suppose it's too late for that now. I blame your parents, personally. More green vegetables at an early age.
You haven't told us about your Oxford trip, Dad, says Mum.
I look at the plate. It's lasagna. I haven't eaten anything yet. I discreetly retrieve my phone from my pocket, and I have a message. I texted Lucas earlier. 1523, Tory Spring. Look, I'm really, really sorry. 1853, Lucas Ryan. It's fine. Kiss. 1906. Tory Spring. Quite clearly, it's not. 1918. I'm so sorry. 1922. Lucas Ryan. It's not even about that, TBH. Kiss. 1929. Tory Spring. Well, why are you avoiding me then?
Dad's finished his dinner, but I've been taking it slow for Charlie.
How are you getting along, Tory? Asks Grandma. Enjoying sixth form?
Yes, yeah, I smile at her. It's great.
They must treat you like adults now.
Oh, yes,
Yeah. 1942, Tory Spring. You at least need to tell me why.
And your lessons are interesting?
Yes, very.
Thought much about university?
I smile. No, not really. Grandma nods.
You should start thinking, Grandad grumbles. Important life decisions. One wrong move and you could end up in an office for the rest of your life, like me.
How's Becky? Asks Grandma. She's such a lovely girl. It would be nice if you could keep in touch when you leave.
She's fine, yeah? She's good.
Such beautiful long hair.
1945, Lucas Ryan.
Can you meet me in town tonight?
Kiss.
How about you, Charlie? Have you been thinking about sixth form, subjects-wise?
Yeah, well, I'll definitely do classics and probably English, but apart from that, I'm not really sure. Maybe PE or something? Or psychology?
Where are you going to apply?
Higgs, I think.
Higgs?
Harvey Green, Tory School. Grandma nods.
I see.
An all-girls school? Grandad scoffs. You won't find any discipline there. A growing boy needs discipline.
My fork makes a loud noise on my plate. Grandad's eyes flicker toward me and then back at Charlie.
You've made some good, strong friends at that school. Why are you leaving them?
I'll see them outside of school.
Your friend, Nicholas. He's at Truham Sixth Form currently, is he not?
Yeah.
So you don't want to be with him?
Charlie nearly chokes on his food. It's not that. I just think that Higgs is a better school. Grandad shakes his head.
Education. What's that compared to friendship?
I can't take any more of this, and I'm getting much too angry, so I ask to be excused with a stomachache. As I leave, I hear Grandad say,
Girl's got a weak stomach, just like her brother.
I arrive first. It's snowing again. I sit at a table outside Café Riviere. We agreed to meet at 9 p.m, and it's just gone 10:02. The street is empty and the river quiet, but a faint echo of one of those indie bands, maybe Noah and the Whale, or Fleet Foxes, or Foals, or the XX, or someone like that, I can never tell the difference anymore, is drifting out of an open window above my head. The music continues to play while I wait for Lucas. I wait until 9 p.m. Then I wait until 9:15 p.m. Then I wait until 9:30 p.m. At 10:07 p.m, my phone vibrates. 2207, Lucas Ryan.
Sorry. Kiss.
I look at the message for a long time. At the single word without a full stop. At the tiny, meaningless X. I place my phone on the table and look up at the sky. The sky always seems to be lighter when it's snowing. I breathe out. A cloud of dragon breath sails above my head. Then I stand up and start to walk home. Chapter 4. In Wednesday assembly, the sixth formers spread themselves along five sectioned-off rows of the hall seating. You have to fill up all the gaps, otherwise not everyone will fit in the hall, so you don't get to choose where you sit. This is how I end up accidentally sitting between Rita and Becky. As people are filing into the seating rows, Ben Hope, back at school with a moderately bruised face, stares directly at me. He doesn't seem angry or scared, and he doesn't even try to ignore me. He just looks sad, like he's about to cry. Probably because he's not going to be popular anymore. I haven't seen Ben and Becky together yet, which is a sign that maybe Becky actually listened to my explosion. I think about Charlie. I wonder where Michael is. I wish Ben didn't exist. Kent's taking the assembly. He's talking about women. Most of our assemblies are about women. But I'm going to tell you the absolute truth. You, as women, are at an automatic disadvantage in the world. Becky, on my right, keeps changing which side she crosses her legs. I make a conscious effort not to move. I don't think that many of you realize how fortunate you have been so far. I start counting Kent's pauses under my breath. Becky doesn't join me. Going to the best girls' grammar school in the county is an unbelievable privilege. I can see Lucas two rows in front of me. He managed to catch eyes with me as he was sitting down on the way in, and I didn't bother trying to look away. I just stared. I don't even feel angry, really, about him standing me up last night. I don't feel anything. I know that many of you complain about the hard work, but until you've faced the real world, the world of work, you can't understand the meaning of hard work. Rita taps me suddenly on the knee. She holds out her hymn sheet. Underneath the lyrics, "To love, shine a light," she has written, "You're isolating yourself. You are going to face a phenomenal shock once you leave this school. This school where all are treated as equals." I read it several times, then study Rita. She's just someone I know. I'm not really friends with her. "You are going to have to work harder than men to get to where you want to be. That is the simple truth." She shrugs at me. "Therefore, I hope that while you're at this school, you'll think about and be appreciative of what you've got. You are all very lucky. You have the potential to do anything you want to do and to be anything you want to be." I fold up the hymn sheet into a paper plane, but I don't fly it because you can't do that in assembly. Everyone stands and sings, "Love, shine a light," and the lyrics nearly make me laugh out loud. On my way out, I drop the paper plane discreetly into Becky's blazer pocket. I don't sit with anyone at lunch. I end up not having any lunch, actually, but I don't mind. I walk around the school. At many points during the day, I wonder where Michael could be. But at other times, I'm fairly sure that I don't care. I haven't seen Michael all week. I have been thinking a lot about his skating. National Youth Semifinals. I wonder why he didn't tell me about it. I wonder why he isn't here. I'm sitting against the tennis courts, surrounded by seagulls, which is odd, because they should have migrated by now. It's period five. Music. I always skip Wednesday period five, because that is our performance practice lesson. I am watching as every girl in year seven makes her way out of the main school building and onto the field. Some running, most laughing, and each with a collection of party poppers in her hands. I can't see any teachers. I don't know what Solitaire has said to Year 7, but it is clear to me that this is its doing. I take out my phone and load up Google. I type in Michael Holden, and then I type in the name of our town. Then I press enter. Like magic, my Michael Holden appears in the search results. The first result is an article from our county newspaper entitled, "Local Teen Wins National Speed Skating Championship." I click on it. It takes a while to load. My knees start to bob up and down in anticipation. Sometimes I hate the internet. The article is about 3 years old. There is an accompanying picture of 15-year-old Michael, but he doesn't look so very different. Maybe his face is a little less defined. Maybe his hair is a little longer. Maybe he's not quite so tall. In the picture, he is standing on a podium with a trophy and a bunch of flowers. He is smiling. Local teen Michael Holden has skated to victory at this year's National Under-16 Speed Skating Championships. Holden's previous victories include Regional Under-12 Champion, Regional Under-14 Champion, and National Under-14 Champion. The head of the UK Speed Skating Authority, Mr. John Lincoln, has spoken out in response to Holden's undeniably extraordinary run of victories. Lincoln claimed, "We have found a future international competitor." Holden clearly displays the commitment, experience, drive, and talent to bring the UK to victory in a sport that has never received satisfactory attention in this country. I head back to the search results page. There are many more articles of a similar nature. Michael won the Under-18 Championships last year. I guess this is why he was angry when he came second in the semi-final. And fair enough. I think I would be angry if I were him. I sit there, staring at Google for some time. I wonder whether I feel starstruck. But I don't think that's really it. It just seems momentarily impossible for Michael to have this spectacular life that I don't know about. A life where he's not simply running around with a smile on his face, doing stuff that has no point. It's so easy to assume you know everything about a person. I click off my phone and lean back against the wire fence. The Year 7s have now congregated. A teacher runs out of school toward them, but she's too late. The Year 7s shout a countdown from 10, and then they lift their party poppers into the air and let loose, and it sounds like I've wandered onto a World War II battlefield. Soon everyone is screaming and jumping, the streamers spiraling through the air like some crazy rainbow hurricane. Other teachers begin to show, also screaming. I find myself smiling, and then I begin to laugh, and then instantly feel disappointed in myself. I shouldn't be enjoying anything that Solitaire is doing. But also, this is the first time in my life that I have ever felt a positive emotion toward Year 7. Chapter 5. I'm on my way home on the bus when Michael finally decides to make his dramatic reappearance. I'm sitting in the second seat from the back on the left, downstairs, listening to Elvis Costello like the goddamn hipster I am, when he spontaneously cycles up beside me on his mouldy old bike so that he is rolling down the road at the same speed as the bus. The window that I'm looking out of is all grimy, and the snow has dried water droplets into it, but I can still see his smug old face in profile, grinning in the wind like a dog hanging its head out of the car. He turns, searching along the windows, eventually realizing that I am, in fact, directly adjacent to him. Hair billowing, coat flapping behind him like a cape, he waves freakishly and then slaps his hand so hard on the window so that every stupid kid on the bus stops throwing whatever they're throwing and looks at me. I raise my own hand and wave, feeling quite ill. He keeps this up until I get off the bus 10 minutes later, by which time it has started to snow again. I tell Nick and Charlie that they can go on without me. When we're alone, we sit on a garden wall, Michael propping his bike up against it. I notice that he isn't wearing his school uniform. I look to my left, up at his face. He's not looking at me. I wait for him to start the conversation, but he doesn't. I think he's challenging me. It's taken longer than it should for me to recognize that I want to be around him. I say, forcing the words out. Sorry. He blinks as if confused, turns to me, and smiles gently. It's okay, he says. I nod a little and look away. We've done this before, haven't we? He says. Done what? The awkward apology thing. I think back to the manically depressed psychopath comment. This isn't the same, though. That was me being stupid and his anger getting the better of him. That was just words. I didn't know Michael at all back then. Michael still has that spark, that light. But there's more there now. Things that cannot be seen, only found. Where have you been? I ask. He looks away and chuckles. I got suspended for Monday afternoon, yesterday, and today. This is so ridiculous that I actually laugh. Did you finally give someone a nervous breakdown? He chuckles again, but it's weird. That could probably happen, to be fair. His face changes. No, yeah. I swore at Kent. I snort. You swore? You got suspended because you swore? Yep, he scratches his head. Turns out Higgs has some sort of policy on that. The land of oppression, I nod, quoting Becky. So how did that happen? It sort of started in history, I guess. We had our mock mocks a couple of weeks ago, and we got our marks on Monday. And my teacher held me back after the lesson because, predictably, I did really badly. I think I legitimately got an E or something. So she started having a real go at me, you know, raving on about how much of a disappointment I am and how I don't even try. That's when I started to get pretty annoyed because, like, I clearly tried. But she kept going on, and she held up my essay and pointed at it and was like, "What do you think this is? Nothing in this makes sense. Where's your point evidence explanation? Where's your PEE? Basically, she ended up taking me to Kent's office like I was some primary school kid. He pauses. He isn't looking at me. And Kent started his big speech about how I should be better than this, and I'm not committing enough to schoolwork, and I'm not putting in enough effort. And I tried to defend myself, but you know what Kent's like. As soon as I started trying to reason with him, he got all aggressive and patronizing, which made me even more angry, because, you know, teachers simply cannot admit to a student that they could possibly be wrong. And then, like, I didn't mean to, but I was like, you don't even fucking care, though, do you? And, yeah, I got suspended. This reminds me of the Michael who Nick described the first day of term. But instead of finding this story a little strange, I actually feel pretty impressed. What a rebel, I say. He gives me a long look. Yes, he says, I'm awesome. Teachers really don't care, though. Yeah, I should have known that, really. We both return to staring at the row of houses opposite. The windows are all orange from the setting sun. I scuff my shoes on the snowy pavement. I kind of want to ask him about his skating. But at the same time, I feel like that's his thing, his special private thing. I've been pretty bored without you, I say. There is a long pause. Me too, Michael says. Did you hear about what the Year 7s did today? Yeah, that was hilarious. I was there. I always sit on the field Wednesday, period 5, so I was literally right there. It was like it was raining streamers or something. He seems to stop moving. After a few seconds, he turns his head slowly toward me.
That was a lucky coincidence, he says.
It takes me a minute to get what he's saying. It's ridiculous. Solitaire would have no way of knowing that I always skip that lesson and sit on the field. Teachers hardly notice most of the time. It's ridiculous. But I start thinking about what Michael said before. About Star Wars, Material Girl, the cats, the violin, and the Ben Hope attack. That was about my brother. But it's impossible. I'm not special. It's entirely impossible. But there have been a lot of coincidences. Yeah, I say, just a coincidence. We both stand up and start to walk along the gradually whitening path, Michael pushing his bike along beside him. It leaves a long grey line behind us. Little white dots of snow rest in Michael's hair. What now? I ask. I'm not quite sure which now I'm talking about. This minute? Today? The rest of our lives? Now? Michael considers my question. Now we celebrate and rejoice in our youth. Isn't that what we're supposed to do? I find myself grinning. Yes. Yes, that is what we're supposed to do. We walk a little farther. The snow grows from a light sprinkling to flakes as large as 5 pence pieces.
I heard about what you said to Becky, he says.
Who told you?
Charlie.
Who told Charlie?
He shakes his head. I don't know.
When did you talk to Charlie?
He avoids my eye. The other day, I just wanted to make sure you were all right.
What, do you think I'm depressed or something?
I say this much too angrily.
I don't want people to be worried about me. There's nothing to worry about. I don't want people to try and understand why I am the way I am, because I should be the first person to understand that. And I don't understand yet. I don't want people to interfere. I don't want people in my head picking out this and that, permanently picking up the broken pieces of me. If that's what friends do, then I don't want any.
He smiles, a proper smile. Then he laughs.
You really cannot accept that people care.
I don't say anything. He's right, but I don't say anything. He stops laughing. Several minutes pass in silence.
I start to think about 4 weeks ago, when I didn't know Michael, when solitaire hadn't happened. I am aware that I feel sadder about things now. A lot of things around me have been very sad, and I seem to be the only one who can see it. Becky, for example, Lucas, Ben Hope, Solitaire. Everyone is okay with hurting people. Or maybe they cannot see that they are hurting people. But I can. The problem is that people don't act. The problem is that I don't act. I just sit here, doing nothing, assuming that someone else is going to make things better. Eventually, Michael and I end up at the edge of town. It's getting dark now, and more than one street lamp flickers on as we pass, casting a yellow glow across the ground. We walk down a wide alley between two large houses and break out into the fields, slick with snow, that stretch between the town and the river. Whites, greys, blues, everything is a blurry mist, rain on the windscreen, a painting. I stand there,
It all kind of stops. Like I've left Earth. Like I've left the universe. It's beautiful, I say. Don't you think the snow is beautiful? I expect Michael to agree with me, but he doesn't. I don't know, he says. It's just cold. It's romantic, I guess, but it just makes things cold. Chapter 6.
So, Tori, Kent scans his eyes over my next essay. What was your opinion this time?
It's Friday lunchtime. I didn't really have anything to do, so I came to give in my next English essay early.
To what extent is marriage the central concern of Pride and Prejudice?
It appears that Kent is talkative today, my least favourite character trait.
I wrote a normal essay.
I thought you might, he nods. I still want to know what you thought. I try to think back to when I wrote it. Monday lunch? Tuesday? All the days blur into one.
Do you think marriage is the central concern?
It's a concern, not the central concern.
Do you think that Elizabeth cares about marriage at all?
I picture the film. I think she does. But it doesn't really occur to her when she's with Darcy. Like, she doesn't relate the two together, Darcy and marriage. They're two separate problems.
Then what would you consider to be the central concern of Pride and Prejudice?
Themselves. I put my hands in my blazer pockets. They spend the whole thing trying to merge who they really are and who they're seen as.
Kent nods again, as if he knows something that I don't. That's interesting. Most people say that love is the main theme, or the class system.
He puts my essay in a cardboard folder.
Do you read many books at home, Tori?
I don't read. This seems to surprise him.
Yet you decided to take English literature A-level.
I shrug.
What do you do for fun, Tori?